Hey legends, my name is Mo and welcome to the Can't Can World podcast. I'm a Royal Marine who is dedicated to optimizing human performance and want to bring you exposure to the fantastic people supporting the same aim. What is it really like behind one of the scenes of the world's busiest police forces, and how does it take its toll on the workforce? My next guest explains all as we hear about what it takes to be better tomorrow than today. If you like what you hear, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast channel for updates on new releases, and why not leave a review on your podcast provider, and follow us on Instagram on the @MoMorrisRM page to show your support. Episode 20, Ed Anrud.
Yeah, I'm good, mate. Good. Life is good. How about you?
Yeah, not too bad. Not too bad. Easter, isn't it? So it was chocolate frenzy yesterday.
God, yeah, children on a sugar high for 48, 72 hours.
Mate, they're always on a sugar high. It's just an epic. But no, it's all right. It's all good. It's all good. It gives me time to record more podcasts and catch up with people and stuff like that. So, yeah, there's no complaints. Not from me anyway. Mate, I appreciate you sending your bio across. It's really interesting, just reading your two lines that you sent me, because you're obviously toppers with...
I can send you a lot more. I didn't want to...
No, I'm only joking. So talk to me about the decision about joining the police in the first place. Why did you do it?
So joining the police was actually an accident. I had my heart set up joining the Corps as a commissioned officer, and... I'd done the POC. I did the POC second time around, the potential officers course, and I went for the Admiralty interview board, and I dipped it, and the recruiter said, come back. And I was a bit disheartened, went away.
Did they say really why?
It was just on some of the sort of psychological exercises. I dipped it slightly. They said you'll nail that when you come back. And I remember just going away, and I was a bit disheartened. And I chatted to someone in the RMR, and they said, "Have you thought about joining the police?" And I thought, "No, I've never ever thought of doing that. Why would I want to do that?" And you know, I just finished uni. I worked for the Home Office for a year. I needed something. I thought, "Well, I'll apply. Is it like a backup plan?" Whilst I train, whilst I keep my training up to go back and apply for the Corps. And I applied. 2 weeks later, they said, come for an interview. So it was, okay, all right. So I went for an interview, and they went, that was really good. And a month later, they were like, you're in. And I started at Hendon Police Training College with a bit of the shock of capture, almost thinking, I didn't think this would happen. And it kind of went from there, and I wasn't too sure. If I was honest, to start off with, if I've made the right decision. But as the training went on, I'd always said, I don't want a desk job, and I want a job where I can make a difference in some way. I'm actually make a difference in what I do. It's not number crunching, I actually do a job. And that's sort of how that came about, really.
So a bit of a whirlwind sort of few months for you then.
It was, yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong, I loved Hendon. I thought it was great. I ended up being the class captain, and we had a great, great bunch of people. It was at a time when the police were massively recruiting. You know, it was churning huge numbers through Hendon. And
this is Met Police, right?
Yeah, the Met Police, yeah. So the Met Police were massively on recruiting. And, yeah, I had amazing instructors. I had some amazing people in my class, and we had a great time.
I speak to other people about what Royal Marines training was like, and I've been through it myself, and you know, that's all great. And there's other people that I've spoken to, interviewed on this podcast, that have gone into detail with that. But what about police training? It's not something that you would normally hear descriptor from people to see what it was actually like.
So it's very different to what it's like now. At the time, it was 18 weeks up at Hendon, and a lot of it, the first couple of weeks or the first week, were all about diversity and equality. And I've come from, I grew up in South London, and I came from a very diverse community. My dad's South American, and I was sat there, and a couple of us were sat there going, why are we being taught this? We didn't really, like, why are we being taught this? And then it wasn't until we started mixing with our team, our classmates, that you saw that actually some people who have come from some really far-flung parts of the UK have never met anyone from an underrepresented group, and that, you know, they could, the best will in the world, they're ambassadors for the police, you know, the Met police, they're going to someone's house and actually offend them by not knowing anything about the culture. So then it all kind of dawned on me, and it was like, all right, okay, it's bringing everyone into the mix, making sure we all understand. But the training, it was good. It was a lot of law, as you can imagine, a lot of stuff. And then we moved into sort of handcuffing and the batons and stuff like that, and CS exposure, which was, that was interesting.
The CS?
So each police officer is changed now, but it was like a little tin you had of CS spray. And that was an irritant, and you'd use that, and you have to undergo exposure to know what it's like. So the first time you use it, because it is horrible, and I've only ever used it once in my career, and there's a reason for that, but it affects you, it affects everyone.
So you get you have to spray it in each other's faces, basically.
They have like a massive, it's not like the military, they put you in a chamber.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's probably second rate the way you do it. Like we fully inhale it like in a chamber.
No, it's not like that. we do go in a chamber for CBRN training, but you're not supposed to inhale it. But they have like a fire extinguisher with it, and they used to hose it up and down, and you had to walk through that. And a lot of people were in a bad way, like people on the floor, you know, like covering their faces and stuff like that. That was the sort of exposure, CS.
Because it's used for what, though? So CS spray is used for?
It's basically if you're dealing with a violent, aggressive person, and you can't get near them to hit them, and it's used to kind of create distance, but also if they're to stop them being violent towards you or a member of the public.
So like a non-lethal use of force, basically.
Yeah, it's a less lethal weapon. It's a less lethal bit of kit. It's a tactical option. A bit like baton, but obviously you don't have to hit someone if you get near them to hit it with CS. So yeah,
I want to go back to that cultural training that you did, because I think it's quite topical at the moment. It's very topical, actually. You said you did a couple of weeks, and actually, what you found by what you've said is that it wasn't necessarily for you; it was for other people that hadn't come from a diverse community per se. But yes, you would have learned things. Did you think it was valuable, and did you think it was current?
Okay, so diversity-wise, I mean, I learned a lot around cultures that I didn't actually know. I mean, to start off with, I was kind of sat there going, why am I here? But then it dawned on me, and then it became more apparent. And then when I actually left Hendon and went to Lewisham as a police officer, you know, there were huge Vietnamese communities, Sri Lankan, and people from, you know, the West Indies and Africa and Jewish religions and Sikh, etc. And it was whilst putting it into practice going, oh, I know why this is happening in this culture, or this day is, or Ramadan's happening, and I know I need to bear this in mind. And it really became apparent. And then when you exhibited this, when you went to people's homes, there was a mutual respect. They went, oh, he knows what's happening today, and he knows why it's religious, and why, you know, you have to show that you always show that respect, but you show more respect around certain times of year because of things that are going on, you know, more consideration is probably a better term for it. I think, yeah, London's one of the most diverse cities in the world, and it has moved on. That training didn't just stop and stand still. It was really relevant, really current, and it's evolved very well, I think, that sort of training. And it is really inclusive of everyone. And, you know, it's not just about race. We're talking about 9 protected strands, you know, LGBTQ+. We're talking about age, sex. We're talking about all sorts. And, yeah, I think it's really good the way it's moved on. And there's a lot of looking, not now just within the police, but taking best practice from outside. So it might be what the military do, or it might be what the private sector do, but it is really good. And yes, the police is becoming a police officer now is, you know, it was said when I joined, it was like you join the police at one of the toughest times. Then all the people then said that. Now I'd say it's even harder because of the world we live in, and obviously things have happened with the police, and you know, and recently, you know, you see the media and the terrible things that happened around Sarah Everard's death. And now more than ever, there has to be that diversity and inclusion and trust. within the police. And yeah, it's essential. This training is spot on, and I'm glad to say it's really evolved.
Interesting that you brought up the Sarah Erard case. The way that the media et al, it's not all about the media, but the way the media, society portray the police when tragic situations like that happen, is that a fair reflection of the police? And if it isn't, what does that do to the morale of the rest of the police force if it's not reflective?
Okay, well, you've got to understand, although that was one person, too many. And that was a terrible thing that happened. There are things that have happened, within a police force of over 30,000 and police staff, police officers, police staff, where things have gone on and trust has been eroded, particularly around that. And do I think it's a fair representation? I'd say no, because I'll tell you now, I've worked in the police service 19 years. I'm a chief inspector. I've never seen racism. I'm not saying it's never existed, but I've never seen racism. I've seen people who may have been a bit close to the mark in unprofessional way, and I'll tell you now, they are called out massively by the police officers around them, and they are dealt with very robustly. There is certainly nothing sort of sexism, racism, where I've actually seen that, because I tell you now, people are jumped on by other officers and they're very strict on that. And it does affect morale. Yeah, it does. As a police officer, you see that. And I feel terrible that we as a police service have let the public down, that's happened, that we're letting them down. It's a reflection on me. We're all ambassadors for this. Like, if it happens in the Corps, you're a Marine, you it's an ambassador. And we do talk, police officers talk, and they go, this is terrible. We want the trust from the community. We set out every day, and there are police officers who I've been in charge of, particularly in the last year, who've gone out, kissed the families goodbye, and they might not be coming home. And it's that high risk what we're dealing with. And yet they're seeing this in the public, and they're getting slammed, and we are, as an organisation, getting under scrutiny. And yeah, quite a lot of it is correct. But then all the majority of police officers go out to protect the public. We take an oath, we take an attestation, to save life, to protect the public. And it does hit you. I'd be lying if I said it doesn't hit you. But we strive. That just makes every police officer more strive to be better, and to sort of gain that trust back from London.
How is that trust gained back?
So it's retrieved through hard work. It's retrieved through having the highest standards, maintaining the highest standards, living to those, holding ourselves accountable, being open and honest with everyone, the community, the public we serve. It's about working hard, and everyone I've ever worked with have worked exceptionally hard to reduce crime, the fear of crime, safeguard vulnerable people. In particular, at the moment around violence against women and girls, it's a major thing. We've got to focus on sort of the mayor of London's plan, and also the new commissioner when they come in, their plan, and it is just involving the community. It's not we can't solve all these problems as one police service on our own. We need everyone else to help us. It's about that partner, getting everyone else on board, going, we're all going to do it as a one. We're not going to, it's not us and you, it's us together.
I think we had a loose conversation before about, like, resource, and resource everywhere, whether it's private, public sector, is reducing. It's becoming a premium. I think, is in fairness, no matter what stage of time in human history, we probably always moan about resource of some description, right? We need enough more people. We need to do this. We need more money. And it never is there. But it's probably fair to say that with the police's role, certainly from a grassroots perspective, that resource is quite important, because, when I was kicking around, and I'm not even that old, I'm 40 years old, like, we used to have community police officers that you'd see regularly, and you'd almost not be friends with them, but you'd have a relationship that was not negative, if we use that as the baseline, and then anything up from there. But they seem to be, like, less now, if at all. And do you think that I personally think that that would be a huge step in the right direction to gaining trust. I just wonder what your thoughts were on that.
Yeah, it is. I understand. So there's those. I know when I grew up, I got robbed when I was 14, and a police officer.
You didn't have
up.
Anything to rob.
Hey, hang on a second. You know, I was a bit of a fly guy. You know,
you're not the clothes you used to wear. No chance.
Whoa, that's strong. I got robbed when I was 14, and it probably shook me up, if I'm honest. And the police officer that turned up was excellent. I mean, the guy, there was a male and female police officer. They turned up and they were on it. They were like, right, tell me what they're like. Get in the car, we're going and look for them. And we didn't find them, but the way they dealt with me, the way they treated me when I was a victim, I went away from that. It was such a positive interaction that that's probably what helped me, probably guided me towards the police when someone mentioned it, because I had such a positive interaction with those officers. And I'd not really seen the police since, until I had an interaction with them until I joined. But having that community, Bobby, yes, it is. But then it's all about priorities. And like you say, it's a public sector. We have to save money, and we've got to utilize those resources more effectively. But I'd say not that that's an area that I actually particularly work in, but when I did work in community policing, and I was a sergeant on the Safe Neighbourhood team, we would regularly go out, we'd have local businesses in, and we'd have meetings with them. And it was all about engagement and getting to know people and being on first name terms. And you've got to understand now that with the edge of social media, a lot of the talking when I was on a ward in Brockley in Lewisham was through Twitter. So I'd be on the Twitter page, I'd have a Twitter page for it. And a lot of my sort of local residents would chat to me openly on Twitter because they're going to work every day. So they're at work, they come home. If something was happening in the local community, I'd put something on Twitter like, we've done a raid on this location and we found this amount. And the positive sort of feedback I got was great, because they were like, this team, this group of people, these police officers are really going out of their way to make this place safe for my children and everything. And when I was on the territorial support group, we used to have something called a crime week, where a PC would be given a task of, right, there is a problem in this location. So Lambeth, I got given a tasking. It's quite a hostile estate because there was quite a few people who were selling drugs around there, committing robberies. That didn't live there, but were just using it as an area to conduct their criminality. And you ended up with tasking, and you had 30 people, so like a troop, like the highest motivated tier one public order people, and highly experienced cops. And it was like, right, design me methods, design me tactics. You've got a week. And I loved it, and we thrived on it. And we'd go in and we'd speak to local residents, going, right, what's the problem? They're going, well, my child can't go and play in the they can't play in the sort of local park because they find drugs. There's knives in bushes. There's people doing stuff after hours, in the darkness. And we'd go in there and we'd absolutely obliterate it. Like, we'd go in, we'd find all this stuff. We'd seize it. We'd, if there were people up to badness or criminality, we'd arrest them, and put them through the legal justice system. And then at the end of the week, I think it started on the Monday, by Wednesday night, we pretty much cleaned the place up, and we were getting residents come up to us with like cups of coffee and chocolates and stuff, going, look, thank you so much for what you've done. It's made a massive difference to me and my children, that I can send them out before dinner and they can go and play and I can see them and I know they're safe. That engagement can be done in different ways, not necessarily local, Bobby, like when we were growing up, but yeah, it's social media as well is a big driver.
So going back to Hendon, what was it about the training that you really enjoyed?
I really enjoyed. So I watched The Bill.
Who didn't?
I joined.
They used to film that. Used to film it on the Cambridge Estate,
Oh, right. Okay, I didn't know that. I've met the real life Tony Stamp as well. Top guy.
I thought he was going to say you've met the real life Tony Stark then, and then I would have been impressed.
No, sorry, not quite, mate. literally, it was just, it was starting to do what I thought the police did. So, it was stopping people, it was helping people, it was doing the actual training around scenarios based stuff. We had an operation called Operation Narrowboat, which was at the end of your training. You were sent out two of you were sent out with to the local borough as a high visibility operation, and you go and be a cop for like the day, a proper cop with another cop. And it was like, right, I'm actually out doing this now. And I was actually with a guy who's a bootneck, a former bootneck. And so
that's another name for a Marine.
Yeah, sorry. A guy who used to be in the Marines.
And I told you before, no acronyms. You have to explain
sorry.
It.
sorry. So a guy who was a Marine, and another officer who was very, very funny. And we went out and it was real policing. And I thought, this is what I joined to do. And this is what we've trained to do. And that was really good. And it was just seeing, you know, hearing stories from them about how great it was. And, you know, and actually seeing it, I was like, right, okay, I'm really loving this now. And then you got talks by specialist teams. So we had the territorial support group come in, who were the METs, tier one, public order operators, and working sort of covert, overt world. And then we had SO19, it was at the time, come in, who's specialist firearms. And they, you know, shooting off a load of guns, and that was fantastic, and loved all of that. And that sort of caught my interest. And I was like, right, this is something I potentially will look to if I stay in the police. You know, I'd like to go and become a really good cop and then maybe look at some specialist sort of way of doing it.
So did you see yourself coming to the end of the training, you thought, this is me, I'm where I'm supposed to be? Or did you think, no, this is still short term, I've got aspirations to do something else?
I thought, this is actually, yeah, I'm getting into this. I'm really liking this. And when you come towards the end of the training, you go to that borough and you start on, you get what's known as puppy walked. So it was called street duty. So it's 10 weeks where they don't just kick you out as soon as you leave Hendon. It's like, right, you're a police officer, good luck. It that would be crazy. They put you with mentors for 10 weeks. And I had a mentor called Tim, who was a boxer, very physically fit guy, coming up towards the end of his career, still had the passion and the love for doing it, which after 28 years is good. And he'd stayed a PC his whole life, you know, and he'd stayed as a beat duty cop, as they're called, so out on the street. And it was fantastic. We were out arresting bad people, we're in car chases, running after baddies that robbed suspects that robbed people and catching them and then returning that property. It was really good. And I really, every day, no day was the same. You go into work and you'd be like, well, I don't know what's going to happen in the next hour, let alone the next 8 hours. And I remember my granddad, who's was ex Royal Marine, and I went home and he said, oh, what did you do today? And I went, oh, well, we did this, we caught all these drugs, and he was loving it as well. So I knew then, I was like, right, I'm actually loving this now. I'm going to see where this goes, because this is good fun.
So how long did you do street duties for then?
So that was 10 weeks. And then you get sent to, I got sent to a response team, which basically is like your, sort of the bill policing. So you go around doing 999 calls.
Is that a natural progression? Does everybody do that?
It was. So yeah, you did your street duties, slightly different now, but you do your street duties, and then you might go. I went to response team in Lewisham, and dealing with 999 calls. Some other people might go to different places now. So you might go to Safe Neighbourhood for that community bit for a bit. You might go to an attachment to the CID, sort of the detectives dealing with sort of more complex crime. But yeah, I went to a response team, and I did that for 3 years, and it was a very young team, and I was very, very lucky that I had some incredible leaders who I'm now lifelong friends with, and it was just the best. One of them was an ex-parachute regiment guy who I gave no stick at all about being an ex-para, but the leadership was fantastic, and the team, it wasn't like going to work, it was like going to see your friends, and it was just so good. And we achieved so much. It really was good. It was like you could come away from work and I had a great day and I did some great stuff.
Yes, when you can be involved in that type of environment, it doesn't feel like work. You know, I can attest to that. And a lot of the time, it's not necessarily where you are and what you're doing, it's who you're with. You could perceptually have the worst job in the world, and everybody perceptually could look at it and go, ha, look at what you're doing, and you know, and take the piss and mock it. But with the people that you're with can make it the most amazing experience. So it's lucky that you had that. So what happened after that then? So you did 3 years doing that, and then what was the next stage?
I did 3 years doing that, and it was challenging me, but it wasn't challenging enough. And that's not me talking down the team that I was with or what we were doing. It's vital work, but I was just like, I need more for this. And I remember seeing these guys and girls come in ultra fit, like, you know, look like triathletes, some of them like, you know, sort of CrossFitters before that was a thing, and always like, you know, people out of the 300 movement, they come in and they would always bring in the most violent prisoners, or they'd be involved in covert ops that you never knew about until it all went off, and they're looking ultra calm, collected, incredibly professional. I just thought, I want to do that. And it was a territorial support group, and I applied, and I went on an attachment, and that was incredible. We were arresting some really high level people. We stopped a car, and it had a couple of kilos of drugs in the back and all sorts of stuff. And they trained as well. They trained before their shift, so they trained as a team. So it was quite a military sort of ethos, and quite a few ex-military. And there was guys and girls in there, and you know, you talk about, you know, the grand scheme of things, oh, sexism, stuff like that. The girls were just as capable as the guys in a fight, trust me, because we had a bit of milling during this attachment. I saw two girls literally kick the out of each other, and they weren't stopping, and they had to be stopped in the end because they just would not give up. And that was the mentality. And I did that, and I joined the TSG for 5 years. And it's probably the best 5 years of my career. I made friends for life. The leadership, again, was incredible. I got involved in some very high-level operations, student riots, the Tottenham riots, really made a difference. I sort of really leaned towards covert operations, in particular with sort of undercover officers protecting them during sort of drug dealing sort of stuff.
Is there any standout stories that you've got? Noting that I appreciate you can't give any details specifically, but where you can, is there any sort of loose stories that you'd be able to tell of that time and to sort of articulate why it was so standout and the sort of things that you were doing?
Yeah, so one of them was we conducted an operation in Southeast London against a massive drug dealing ring. And I'd been one of the protection team for these undercover officers who were gaining evidence on their sort of activities. And it was really quite high risk. And there came a day where it was like, right, we now have all this evidence against them. We now need to go and arrest them. And this, we didn't know where they lived, and so you had to arrest them in the street. And it was, this sounds really bad, but it was probably the most adrenaline packed day ever, 24 hours of my life. I was in 6 car crashes that day. One of them where I was in the car and got flung out the car as it rolled over. How I'm still alive. it was, there were a couple of times where I was like, I'm lucky I'm still alive. You know, we were literally confiscated. I mean, we 10 kilos of crack cocaine we found in the freezer. You know, it was ridiculous. And we were chasing cars that day. And the last sort of arrest phase against a group, there were two guys that were in a BM, like a fast car, sat with the windows open with the engine ready to go. And they were dealing drugs to people who were going to a nightclub. They come around the corner getting the drugs. And we knew they were doing it. So we were like, right, we're going to have to try and arrest them. And I thought, right, okay. So me and some other guys were dressed up pretty, you know, in pretty crappy clothes. And we thought, right, we'll just go
on. Your normal clothes then?
Yeah, you know, my normal wardrobe, my normal tie, you know, threads, dress to impress. And in South London. And so I've gone, right, I'm going to go for the ignition. So I'm going to go for the keys. As soon as we get the keys, the car drive off, unless it's game on. And I remember going, as I walked up to the window, I thought, I'm going to have to be quick because these guys potentially armed with something. And I dived through the window and I got the key. And as I got the key, unfortunately, this guy's a huge bloke and his hand's gone over my hand. And I just thought, right, this is not going to end well. And he's driven. And me and another guy called Nick, Nick's dived through the other window to try and stop the passenger doing anything. And he's driven off. This car's driven off. I was like, oh, my God. And my feet are hanging out the car. And we're hurtling down the road. And I know if I hit anything, a lamppost, that's me. I'm potentially going to die here. And luckily, the team that are supporting us have seen it. And they've gone, right, we need to end this now. So we've had like a head-on collision because they're trying to save our lives. And they've had a head-on collision. At that point, literally all the airbags have gone off in the car. I've been squashed against the guy's chest because my head's down trying to like hold on. And then I've been flung from the car. All the glass has exploded in the car. And Nick's been thrown from the car. We're in quite a dark alleyway, and the suspects have tried to get out of the car. You know, they're a bit dazed. No one's wearing a seatbelt. They're a bit dazed. They've got out of the car. Everyone's stumbling around. And there was a police officer who was on attachment, just joined the police, and he was on attachment, and he got out of the car and was like, right, okay, I've got to stop them. And he's confused me with one of the suspects. And whilst I'm sort of praying and thanking God that I'm alive, he's emptied a load of CS at me, covered in blood and everything. And I thought, thanks for that. Me and Nick sort of got up, and we found a kilo of cocaine in the boot of the car. And these guys went to prison for a long time. And they were dealing to like vulnerable young girls, you know, who God knows what was going to happen there. You know, it's terrible. And me and Nick were sat there laughing, covered in blood and glass, just going, we're alive. His hand was broken. And we're like, this is the best 24 hours ever, because we put a lot of these people through the system and then got so much drugs off the street. There was another time where I chased a car through an area with a friend of mine, and it wasn't stopping. And it was a guy who was drug driving, and he wouldn't stop. It was school kicking out time, and we were going through Bromley, Chislehurst, and this guy nearly ran over some kids, school kids, and we couldn't stop him. It was a very high-powered sports car he was in, and he got balked in traffic, and we were trying so badly to stop it. And it drove into a Sainsbury's car park where there was a load of women, mums with their kids, dads with their kids, and we thought someone's going to die here. So I've ended up bailing out the car. And it was like a U, sort of cul-de-sac thing, this car park. And I've gone, right, okay, I've got to stop him. And luckily, got blocked in. I've thrown my baton through the driver's side window. It's smashed. And as I've dived through, this guy's picked a knife up from the door pocket, and he stabbed me in the arm. And I thought I got punched. I didn't really register until I was dragging him out of the car. And there was quite a lot of blood going down my arm. And I was like, there was a knife, and the first instinct was like, I'll just pull that out. So I'll just pull it out through it to one side, and we got him. So it was things like that, and the Tottenham riots in particular, that were really sort of standout moments. But you know, we were making the difference.
I can't get in my head why people like yourself would, on a daily basis, risk your lives to do that.
So this is not the majority. When I say this is not every person who may be involved in criminality or every person. These are very select people, and police officers go out every day to keep members of the public safe. That's why we join up. That's why we go out. And it doesn't matter if you're a cop with a gun. It doesn't matter if you're a community support officer, a police staff. We all go out as a police service to go in and protect the public, and no matter what rank you are. And the levels of violence I've kind of had throughout my career towards me were quite extreme. I've been stabbed, I've been shot, I've had someone throw at the Tottenham riots. I got out of the police carrier. I luckily had a NATO helmet on, and I had a machete slung at my head, which missed my head by about an inch. I've had someone launch an axe at me from across the room, and it was like a Matrix moment where I've literally leaned back and this thing has gone over my shoulder and gone into the wall behind me. And we deal with some incredibly dangerous people, especially when you talk about sort of counter-terrorism operations. The risk is so high. Why do we do it? Because you train to do it. So we train to do it because you want to be that tip of that spear. but also because you want to stop this. You don't, we all have friends, we all have families. And it's like, I want to protect my friends, my family, and the public from this. And I am trained to this highest level. And I, you know, I took an oath, I took an attestation that I will stop it no matter what. And I think definitely that has definitely driven me through quite a few things. It's also like things like, so that motivation around sort of counter-terrorist specialist firearms was, my brother's in the Marines. 12 years ago, he was involved in a big scrap in Afghanistan, and I'm his older brother, and he nearly died during that. He was very close to being killed. He's very lucky he didn't die. I picked up the phone to him when he's back at Bastion, and I'm hearing him high up on morphine, but badly hurt. And I was like, I'm his big brother, I can't do anything about that, but I feel terrible about it. You then fast forward to 2017, at Westminster, Keith Palmer was killed amongst some other people, and they were seriously hurt. And I, unfortunately, you know, Keith was a good friend of mine. I watched him die in front of me, and I was powerless to do anything, yet I still had to lead that incident to stop others dying. And then you look at Streatham 2 years ago, in the very neighbourhood I grew up in, people of a similar ideology tried to kill two people and kill a load of us. And it, the motivation is quite strong at that point. And it's a case of, right, I don't want this to happen. I can't let this happen. I'm in a position where I can influence this, where I can stop it. And I, you know, I want to keep London safe. That sounds a bit of a cliche, but I want to be the forefront of stopping that. You know, I so badly want to stop hurt and harm happening to people. And so that is why I do it.
How do you manage yourself then? So how do you stop that motivation clouding your judgment or your decision-making process?
So I turned up to that incident, and at the Westminster attack, it was in March 2017, the start of some unfortunate attacks in the UK and across Europe that changed the way we live, essentially, quite a lot. And I turned up, I didn't realise it was Keith that was stabbed. I turned up to an incident where I was told, I was a senior guy on the ground, I was a senior armed officer on the ground, and I had overall command on the ground there. And it was like, right, we've got potential IED in the car, sorry, an improvised explosive device in the car. We have people trapped under the car. I've got loads of people on that bridge, who Westminster Bridge. And my first update from one of my operational firearms commanders was, boss, we potentially going to have 20 dead people up here. We need to do something quick. And so I've got that to deal with. I've got a bomb in the car. I've got the helicopter emergency services landed 50 metres from the car. So if that goes off, we're all in trouble. I've then got information coming in saying there are armed attackers gone into the palaces of Westminster, and the Prime Minister's in there doing Prime Minister's questions. So I've got a number of protected personnel. I need to get out. I've got people who are potentially going in there to cause harm. I've got multiple armed officers turning up, and I'm going, right, we need to get in there and deal with that. And I saw Keith, when I went over to Keith, and Tobias Holwood, MP, was working hard, the armed officers working hard to try and do everything to save his life. I didn't realise it was him, so I stood over, and he was pretty much, that was him. They were saying there was nothing more we could do. And it was that moment, like in the movie, where, and I equated sort of like a Batman movie, where there's an explosion and it goes silence, and there's white noise when he died. And it just goes white noise, and then it comes back in. And I was like, right, that's my friend's just died in front of me. I used to work with Keith. I was a public order medic on the terrorist support group. I know a lot of his friends. We have a lot of mutual friends. And to see him die, it was the worst thing ever. And it was like, right, something Jack, my brother, said about leadership and the Condor 5. So in the military, the Condor 5, you know, take 5 seconds, take 5 minutes. You know, I had 5 seconds. And I counted back down. I was like, right. He also said, at crucial moments, and this has happened in my career, people are going to turn to you and look for leadership. And if you don't fill that gap, it's going to go to the pot. And it literally was, it was silence. And I just remember everyone turned to look at me, those doctors, those armed officers, the people you know, around me turned and looked at me. And I thought, right, my friend's died. Yes, it's grief, but I need to step up and lead. And, you know, otherwise this is going to go, this is still ongoing. There's potentially still people who are going to cause harm. So it was like, I'll have to part the grief and go and just lead it. And so I did. I would say we're trained such a level in the police that you'll see things and you'll do things, and you know, you'll see things where you'll deal with a child dying, like maybe a sudden infant death syndrome, so a sudden death, a child, a cot death. And I don't have children, but there were guys who potentially went and dealt with those who had children the same age, and they'd go home that night and it'd be like, right, where does, you know, how do you make sure that's not personal? It is a case of I'm professional and trained to such a point that I know if this now is affecting my operational command, I will step aside, and other commanders as well will notice that. And we frequently talk to each other, and there is that sort of balance about work life. And I got it really wrong last year. Not that it affected my operational command or anything like that, but just within my personal space, I let work dominate everything. And we quality assure each other. And I'm very lucky to work in a space where feedback is a gift. And as a senior commander, if one of the junior commanders has got a question or not too sure, or they're not happy, they'll speak to me. They'll say, boss, what about this? What about that? So it's hard, but you do it because you're trained to such a high level that you know you have to follow process procedure.
I want to come back to that point that you just made there about last year in a moment, because I've got a few other questions that are buzzing around my head at the listening to what you're saying. I mean, I think it's fascinating because we never get to hear this sort of stuff. We never get to see this sort of stuff. We only ever get to see when it goes wrong and never when it goes right. Not that the Westminster attack was when it went right, but the tremendous effort from the police to make a bad situation right. We go about our business in about our daily lives like nothing is going on. We go to the shops, we'll take the kids to clubs, we'll go to work, we'll do what we need to do. How close, certainly, does London come to a significant incident happening that no one would ever know about? What sort of work goes on behind the scenes to protect the daily routine of London citizens, shall we say, because obviously that's the area that you work, but no doubt that it will be reflective across the UK.
Basically, a lot of work goes on by a lot of people in the background, the deal with, you know, intelligence, those operations. There's always work ongoing. We're always protecting members of the public. I'd say, you know, my team, so last year I took over, I was very honoured and privileged to take over as Chief Inspector for Counter-Terrorist Specialist Firearms Teams in the Met. They deal with the highest risk over and covert operations in the UK, and they're part of teams that deal with that. And we had our busiest year in 10 years, and that was down to a lot of overt operations, such as like the G7 summit, where we have to protect world leaders, COP26 in Scotland. But we also had a lot of operations where, you know, there's risk to people, not the general public, but maybe specific people through organised criminal networks and obviously counter-terrorist operations. And
when you say protect the people from what?
So it might be. So I'll give you an example. It might be one gang might have a feud with another gang, and they might there might be one person in particular that gets named, and they go, right, we're going to go harm that person. So it would be protecting that person necessarily, or it might be there's a threat made to just a random member of the public, an innocent member of the public or something like that. So it would be protecting individuals, but also the general public, because there may be, you know, there may be people out there that have who have plans to harm the public. I mean, that's no secret, you know, in that respect. So there's a lot that goes on, a lot, but it's there is a lot of hard work by so especially last year, the inspectors, the sergeants, the PCs, the police constables, the operators on my teams worked crazy, and they thrive on it because they're professionals. They are subject matter experts. They're amongst the best in the world at what they do, and they're very professional. But you know, they will work. It's a very sort of high level operation that has to go on, and so you know, they have to staff that, but they do exceptionally well. So I think the British public can rest assured that the police as a whole, every area of policing is going, pushing as hard as they can to keep the public safe.
How real is the threat of terrorism?
Well, we've seen over the years, since 2017, you know, the security state has dropped. It hasn't gone away, but you know, that's been put out on websites, or on news and stuff like that. It's always there. It's not just a police problem. It's a everyone problem. You know, everyone comes together. You look at some of the media reports that have been put out, when people have been arrested for terrorism and stuff like that. And sometimes some of these people will ring up and go, actually, I wasn't too sure about what they were doing, or they were saying this. And it was kind of an extremist mindset. And we get tipped off by those families, that engagement, and then they come and speak to us, all their work colleagues. And there is a lot. I mean, Westminster certainly changed my life, changed a lot of people's lives, but it sent my career in a different direction. I was really happy being an arms inspector on SCN-019, on the response vehicles, the armed response vehicles. And I was really happy doing that. And then that happened, and that totally changed the way I wanted to do things. So I felt like I wanted to make sure what happened to Keith and the others never happened again. I enrolled in university. I did a degree in counterterrorism. I worked around the UK and some parts of Europe and the world, and trying to make sure our command control element and our sort of that initial response was so tight and so good that this couldn't really happen again. And then I worked upstream through university to try and see if I could help to look at, you know, prisons and sort of radicalization, de-radicalization programs, and sort of that radicalization, because we were seeing sort of radicalization issues maybe within prisons, to try and see if we could, you know, fix that upstream. So it was things like that. And then I obviously specialized as counter-terrorist special firearms officer, because I really wanted to be at the forefront of that. So there was always that threat. But there are a lot of people out there working exceptionally hard to counter that.
Just for clarification purposes, for anyone that's listening to this, when we're talking about terrorism and extremism, we're not just talking specifically to do with Islamic radicalization. It's radicalization in any guise. Is that right?
Absolutely. Yeah. That's okay. That's one that's we've seen over the years. You know, the previous years that's been at the forefront. You know, particularly around ISIL sort of stuff. But you look at America. There's all sorts. There's sort of right wing stuff.
Which is still prevalent in the UK as well, right? Right.
Yeah.
Right wing extremism is.
Yeah, you read it in the press. There's some of it, you read it in the press.
I remember there was a 15-year-old from Kingston that was arrested maybe 2 years ago. And what they found in his bag was materials that linked to right-wing extremism. And as I went to investigate, he was running three online right-wing organizations. And in terms of level of where he was in those organizations, was like one of the senior leaders, and he was just went to a grammar school in Kingston. And when he was going up to his bedroom, mum were middle class, reputable people. He was going up to his bedroom doing his homework, but he was that high functioning. He'd be nailing his homework, and then he'd then be radicalizing himself. And he was heavily involved. And when the SO15 picked him up, he was on the way to committing an act of terrorism, which is like unbelievable. A white middle class teenager from the suburbs was involved in that type of work. So it really shocked me when I found out about that, not because of his social demographic, but more the fact that it comes from everywhere. It's not necessarily what you'd be, it would be portrayed on the news and what most people would associate to extremism or extremist behavior.
Yeah, so extremism, like you say, it's not just one little bit. It can be, you know, across a number of things. And it is, again, it comes back to, like I said, it's not, the police can't just solve this on their own. We need everyone. So it's that engagement with the community, engagement with us, coming to us, speaking to us speaking to them. And that is what intervenes, allows us to intervene, allows sort of, you know, other agencies to intervene, and to make sure, like this 15-year-old you mentioned is, you know, we intervene and then work through a program to bring him back to being your typical 15-year-old rather than what he's involved in there. It's everyone together. We can solve this. It's that trust, that sort of stuff. So yeah. But it is you do read the media, and you know, it can be quite shocking what you read in the media. But certainly I'd say from a policing point of view, from what I've done and stuff like that, everyone is working very hard and we are getting better and better at this as every day goes on.
And you know, that's not going to lie, that's fairly reassuring to know. So everyone can sleep slightly easier. Okay, so going back to, there was a comment you made about when you arrived at the scene in Westminster, and you said about what your brother had mentioned about, you know, in extreme times, people will look into leadership. You said something quite specific, that you parked the grief to be able to deal with that situation. When do you get the opportunity to deal with situations like that?
Yeah, I mean, so I'll say 2017, that was a start, like I said, a tidal wave of unfortunate events that happened that year and subsequent years. The NHS and the police and a number of emergency services, I think, kind of noticed that in these large scale incidents, a number of officers were dealing with and medical staff, etc., were doing pretty horrific things. And there was already a lot of occupational health sort of counselling thing in place, and that only got better as those incidents went on, you know, and it was kind of that evidence-based learning around taking what happened in Afghanistan, so with the military and the way they decompressed and sort of the counselling things around that and rock to recovery and bringing that into the sort of civilian mindset, civilian law enforcement mindset and emergency services, that there definitely is now and there's a lot of investment gone into it around human performance and sort of well-being being a big part of this, about protecting the police officers and, you know, mindset and mental health in particular. For me, around Westminster, that was the start of the craziest few years I've ever had. And I got refocused. In fact, I got too consumed by it, I'll be completely honest about, because I was preparing briefings. I had people from all over the UK ringing me up going, how did you deal with that incident? What did you do? This sort of thing. And I work solidly 16 hours a day, about a day, you know, probably 20 hours a day, about a day off for about 4 months. And it was starting to affect me. And it was a friend of mine called Stu, I'll name him, because he came in and he saw me, and I was on the day off and I was in work and I was typing away a report, and he was like, what are you doing here, Ed? And I was like, oh, well, I've got to do this. He goes, aren't you like off this week? And I was like, yeah, I am, but I've got to do this. And he said, right, you're in here every day, you've got to stop. He said, stop right now, you go home, you're not doing it anymore. And he that sort of intervention really helped, because it allowed me to sort of take a bit of time out. I came away from the Westminster operation and that, and I was the senior commander for quite a while. I had survivor guilt, and I had I refused to go to a commendation ceremony, and I there was an assistant commissioner wanted to recognise everyone who turned up and dealt with that incident. And, you know, those guys and girls did exceptionally well. But as the senior commander on the ground, I was in charge of an operation where my friend died and a number of other people died and were seriously injured. I couldn't do a damn thing about it. And I had quite quite an in-depth conversation with the staff officer of that assistant commissioner. I said, I want my name taken off that. I cannot stand up in front of people and shake hands with the commissioner knowing that I feel I have failed and my friend has died and people have died. I can't do that. And that sort of with what happened with my brother, and then you add to the Westminster thing, and it just fueled the fire for wanting to solve this. And for me personally, and it, I'd say it wasn't really put to bed until probably about a month ago, the 5-year anniversary, when I met up with the families of the people that died and the survivors, and I hadn't seen them in 5 years, and they recognized me, and it put it to bed. It was like because I heard from their families and I heard from their survivors, thank you for what you guys did, and you guys and girls did. You did everything you could. It was great. You know, you really were fantastic that day. And that for me was like, right, okay, it's done. But it sat with me for quite some time. And there is opportunity. Don't get me wrong. There is opportunity definitely within the police to do it. But essentially in the last year as well, as being the chief inspector of that, we were so busy. And I was so consumed with making sure my teams are right, making sure they had the right correct kit. Because if we're not doing operations, I'm in charge of projects. I'm in charge of getting the kit, the equipment to them, like you're doing the Marines to get you to be able to do your job. And there's so much that goes with it that I was living and sleeping at work after pretty much August. And I just wanted to make sure they're all right. And you can imagine, so those teams, like you alluded to, high functioning teams, they've got families, they're human beings. They've got they're working really hard. They've got families, and they might come to me and they go, sir, have you got 5 minutes? And I was listening to a podcast the other day with Karen Bradley on it. And she said, one of the greatest things as a leader you can give people is your time. And they come to you, go, have you got 5 minutes? Can we grab a coffee? And I think, well, for you to come to me and ask me that is quite a big thing. And I want to come and help you. So they might go, I've got a bit of problem at home. Can I come off operations for a bit? Or will I be able to do this? And it was all about, right, I want to look after them. The greatest asset of as a leader is in your team of the people. And it was like, I want to, they're high functioning, they take high risks, I want to make sure they're all right. And in doing that, I was listening to them, I was at phone calls, going for coffees, you know, having coffee at work, all that sort of stuff, just making sure they're okay and looking at options around how I can help them in their home lives. But then, you know, when they want to come back and come back into the fold, we can do that. The problem came was where I was doing that for them, and I was totally not doing that for me. And yeah, that's kind of where that led to.
And it's interesting, because I was literally just about, it's like you knew that what my next question was going to be. Leadership is about doing things for everybody else, absolutely. But it's also about making sure that you're okay to be able to do that for other people. And I wonder whether in that time when you said, like when you parked the grief, that the reason, like this, it become a strong motivator for you to be good for everybody else, because you were able to avoid you almost.
Yeah. So I give sort of since last year, I give a presentation on work-life balance, and the second slide I open with is do not do what I did. As a senior leader, I say, do not do what I did, because I got it wrong. And there's a guy called James Clear who wrote Atomic Habits, and he talks about this 4-burner principle, gas burners. So you've got work, health, family, and friends. And the idea, the hypothesis is that you can only really concentrate on three at any one time. And I took over as a chief inspector in January 2021 of those CTSFO teams. And I've worked hard to get there. And it was a real honour and a privilege to get in that role. It's one of the most coveted roles in the Met Police. And I want to do such a great job. And I want to support the people who are doing a great job every day. And as we went through the year, it just, you know, I was getting involved in everything. I wanted to help and I wanted to get involved. And it just became apparent that, you know, I was getting so consumed by work and getting more and more phone calls. You know, you can be a victim of your own success. So the more you do, the more phone calls you're getting, you know, and it was causing problems at home. You know, I was getting, my phone was always going off in the middle of the night. You know, even when I was on leave, my phone's going off. I'm having phone calls. I'm checking emails on a Sunday when really should be spending time with our half and family members. And I was then more and more in work on call more. And I was thriving on it from a worker aspect because I thought, well, I'm sort of making good headway here. And then it was when a guy called Andy McCann came in, and he deals with human performance. And he came in and we had a presentation from him on stress and looking after yourself and leaders. And he pulled up this chart of a lieutenant colonel's heart rate rhythm.
Yeah.
It was from the US guy. Yeah. So, all right. Okay. So, sorry, it was not a US guy. And he showed the heart trace overnight. And although this guy was asleep,
heart rate variability.
Yeah. Guy was asleep, his body was on a high level of stress.
Yeah.
Solid 20.
No recovery.
No recovery. And he lived like that for God knows how many months in Afghanistan. And although you look at him, he's asleep. You know, if you physically looked at the bloke, he's asleep. But his body's not recovering and you can't maintain that. I was stood there with a group of guys and one of the PCs from one of the operators from the teams nudged me and went, I bet that's what yours is like. And I went, you're probably right at the moment. And I joked about it, but I asked for one of those monitors. I asked Andy, what monitor was that? And he said, oh, this. So I asked for one of those for a birthday present and I got it and I wore it for a week. And I was like, it's not far off like this red line thing. And I was like, right, I'm stressing here. And it got more and more and it was sort of, you know, come August, we were involved in a lot of operations and I was sending people all over the place. And it got to a point where I'd injured my back and there was a big thing Andy talked about around you are 40% more likely to get musculoskeletal injury when you are stressed and not getting sleep. And I wasn't sleeping. I'll be honest, I really wasn't sleeping. I was worried about work and emails and more phone calls. And then I was avoiding conversations with my other half at the time around like children and moving in together and stuff like that. And I was emotionally at home. I was very cold. And a few people have said that to me since, you were just very cold. And I was coming out with some random stuff as to why we couldn't have those conversations. It's not really fair on, you know, the other half sort of thing. And it went on and went on and it got to, my back got really bad. It started really affecting me and I was in quite a lot of pain sitting in meetings, but I was still going and doing all the training on the range, running out of cars, climbing up the side of the buildings, abseiling, you name it, because I wanted to leave from the front because that's the way, and particularly me and you being in the Marine Cadets, we were taught you lead from the front and it works and it's really great. And that's my leadership style. And it went on and on. And my parents raised, I'm one of four, my parents raised me and my brothers and sisters quite a stoic mindset that you don't whine, you don't mane, you don't complain, you don't make any excuses. You just get on and do it and you give it your all. And come September, I was having a chat with my wife at the time and things were great. And I said to her, it was really hard to admit. I said, look, I'm struggling a bit here. To do that, I felt like a bit of a failure because I wanted to be that guy for her. And, you know, for my family, I'm the eldest. So, you know, I wanted to be that rock, the eldest brother. I mean, you know, it's like, you know, you want to be that rock for your family. And here I am being vulnerable and I didn't want to do that. And our operational cadence of work got more and more. I was in more and more pain. When I said I was struggling, me and my wife said, all right, okay, I'll tell you what, I said, I'll go to the doctor. And I said to the doctor what was going on as far as I could work-wise on my back. And she said, let's get a blood test. So I had a blood test and the doctors rang me up on the phone for half an hour. So I thought, this is not good. And the doctor said, right, your white blood cell count is through the floor. It's exceptionally bad. And she said, this is a red flag for you. And she said, I don't know what it is you do fully for a living, but you need to be considerate here. And things weren't good at home. I wasn't seeing my family. And I thought, right, okay, maybe I need to change up what I'm doing. I've been doing this for a while now. And maybe I need to do something else. I looked at other roles from policing in a similar sort of field, but something less demanding, should we say, and probably more work-life friendly. And towards December, we were banged out with operations. We were absolutely crazy. And I dealt with a very, very intense operation where I literally, I was working crazy hours. And, you know, it ended up with things going badly with the other half, and that was sort of it. And instantly regretted it. It was me not wanting to cause her any upset and stuff like that. And I tried to have that conversation on zero sleep, and instantly regretted it. And I was like, you know what? And I did it over I had that conversation over the phone, and I felt so bad. And I was like, it's not fair, you know, I shouldn't be doing that. And that sort of was the start of a number of things, which is Johnny Wilkinson did a podcast recently. He said it was a cycle breaker, a thing that made him stand up and go, actually, you need to take a step back. And as a leader, I started to take a step back. And it was my sort of like my dad got ill at Christmas. He's quite old, so I thought maybe this is the last Christmas we're going to spend with him. My sister got ill, my little brother got ill all at once, and I was like, right, my family need me, so I need to sort out. I was like, things my other half is sort of, I want to sort out, but my family immediately, there's potentially them to be really ill. Work was still going on, so I started to kind of do that. So those burners now, everything's going on. It was like fully consuming, max bandwidth. You know, I was maxed out. So Christmas has gone, so I was like, right, I'll try and make sure the family are all right, got them back to full health, or a good health. And then I was like, all right, I need to sort things out at home. I really do need to sort things out. And I'd a new job, and that was looking to start soon. So that was, I didn't want to go back into that situation thinking, you know, we'll just carry on. It was like, right, I'll make this change. I'll address that work-life balance, and it'll all be good. And then one morning, I also couldn't train this time. And training, like for you, is your outlet. It's that kind of keeps you grounded and gives you that sort of mental balance. And I couldn't train. I hadn't been able to train for 6 months. And training for the last 25 years and then not being able to train at all, it was really difficult. And you don't get a stress release, etc. And it kind of just after January, I had some people come to me and go, emotionally you are very cold. They were like, you're not the same guy. You operationally said there's no issue, you know, you're on it, you're making those decisions, it's all good. And they're quality assured anyway, those decisions, through my teams and through fellow commanders. But they said, you're emotionally to chat to, you're just very cold, and that's not right. You know, something not right there. And then I tried doing a bit of training because I thought I need to do that. And the next day, I lost the feeling in my legs and I collapsed at home. I basically face planted after getting out of bed. I couldn't feel below my waist, and managed to get to a hospital, MRI'd, and the doctors, two of them came in, and I was sat in this bed, high up on morphine. I thought, this is not going to be a cool conversation. They sit down and they've got the test results of my blood work from the year, the sort of December. And they say, right, Mr. Anrud, you've got a disc that is potentially causing massive crushing injuries on your spinal cord. If we don't do something about this now, it's going to permanently affect you and your ability to stand up, to walk, etc. And that was that cycle breaker. That was that point where I looked at them and went, you know what? What on earth am I doing? I'm no use to anyone. I'm no use to home. I'm no use to work. I'm no use to anyone. I'm a liability now. They got up, they walked out. They gave me a tenant offer, a right bollocking. I always remember this. They got up, they walked out, and there was a big mirror in front of the hospital that I was sat in, and my eyes just landed looking at myself going, what on earth are you doing, Ed? What on earth, you know, come on, just what the hell? And that was the cycle breaker, I think.
It's pretty pretty astonishing, to be honest. You know, it's interesting what you said about, there's a couple of things you said about when your staff come to you and say, can I have 5 minutes? But as a senior leader, who do you ask for 5 minutes?
So as a senior leader, it's difficult because there are other senior leaders that I can go and speak to. And I did speak to some of them, but you've got all these guys or girls, these ladies are working hard as they are. You know, they're really working hard. So I would, as a senior leader, a lot of people would speak to their friends or their family, you know, as far as you could in that sort of world of what we were doing. But you'd speak to your friends and family because they ground you. The people you know outside of work, they ground you and you might chat to them. But I was so consumed in what I was doing that I was ostracizing the very people who should have been the priority. So we talk, and I'm sure they do in the military world, around having a working strategy. So any operation you do, you have a working strategy and that's your priorities. You know, so for the police, it would be, we've got to protect the public. We've got to protect the other emergency services. We've got to protect the victims. We have to protect ourselves and suspects as well. And something that a team leader at work said, and I overheard, and I wish I'd paid more attention to this at the time. He said, in the working strategy of life, family come at the top always. And that includes you. He said, that always comes at the top. And as a senior leader, yes, you can speak to other senior leaders, but you've got to understand that there's a lot going on. And because we were so busy, you know, you're passing ships and it's like, right, okay, I just wanted to be there for my teams. And I was at work a lot. And if one of them got injured or one of them got hurt, I felt like personally, it affected me personally. It was like, right, okay, I want to make sure they're right. I'd ring them up. You're right, your family, okay, you know, all that sort of thing. Because, you know, a lot of these guys have got, and girls have got young children, and, you know, they kiss their kids goodbye, and when they go to work, they come back, and dad or mum is injured. And it has a massive effect on them. And understandably, you want to look after them, make sure they're okay.
When we talk about well-being in the workplace, and, you know, there's a misconception that we can train people and educate people, which is important and it solves the problem, but actually the issue and the crux of making sure that a positive environment is developed to maintain is through leadership behaviors. And I think that we always look at leadership behaviors synonymous with the doing and going getting and the operations and the output, but we always overlook the leadership behaviors about like self-care. So maybe it might have been that the amazing leadership that you witnessed when you were going through your career didn't have that element in it, which then you then start to adopt yourself. And so in your quest to make sure your teams were absolutely catered for, you're teaching them a leadership behavior that they might adopt and go through themselves when they promote. Do you see what I mean? And it's something that I speak to a lot of people about this, and it's an area that is not, everyone knows it, but it's never prioritized. And actually, how effective would it have been in leadership, I suppose, retrospectively, if your phone was off at a weekend? Now, I know that some of the ops that were highly sensitive, and you wouldn't necessarily been able to do that all the time, but where possible, you could have done. And it's just really interesting when you try to pick it apart to see how when you, your second slide, you say, this is, don't do what I did. What are you now going to do moving forward to make sure you don't do that again?
Right. So it taught me a massive life lesson. You know, I say in this work-life balance thing, I was like, operationally, everything worked. So we achieved what we needed to achieve. The teams were safe. They worked incredibly hard, but, you know, we managed it and it was great. In my personal life, it cost me incredibly dearly. And, you know, my own health and family and relationship, it cost me massively dearly. And I think going forward, when I give this sort of presentation to them, it's important that they see, you know, you've got to be balanced. You have to be balanced. And I say at the end of that sort of that presentation, I say, if there is something, you're sat here as a commander, as a whatever operator, and something has resonated in what I've just said, you can change this in the next 2 minutes. You can call that friend and say, let's meet for a beer or a coffee or whatever. You can say to the family, let's go out to the cinema, or let's go and do this, or let's do this this weekend. Or you can say to that loved one that, you know, your other half, let's go for dinner. Let's just go for a walk. Let's go for a chat. Turn the phone off, leave it. You know, and for me, going forward, it's taught me a massive life lesson, I think, about leadership. You know, my leadership style, yes, I lead from the front. I always will. I'm not saying don't work hard, don't go after what you want. I had that stoic sort of mindset upbringing, and it's kind of a double-edged sword, because one minute it says, don't whinge, don't whine, don't complain, don't communicate, don't make any excuses. But at the same time, when you've got another half who's really worried about you, you don't communicate either, because you don't want to worry him. And it works against you. So I'd say, yeah, you know, keep your friends, stay grounded. People do get it very right. There are people get it right, but unfortunately, and I don't know the full circumstances, there's a senior police officer, I think it's in Cambridge, who took his own life after he retired recently, and he was highly successful, very, very good at what he did. But he took his own life. Now, we don't know the circumstances of that, but a very successful guy, an incredible leader. And yeah, he's done that. That was his only way out. And, you know, it's things like that. It's stopping that. It's intervening and stopping. But, you know, and if I can say in what I'm saying to people, and they resonate, like I said, then they can change it. They can turn it around there and then.
You know, you touched on a really important and poignant point, because the Commandant General of the Royal Marines was in the same position last October. An incredible individual, incredible leader. You know, when he used to turn up to parades, and you see the amount of medals that he had on his chest and the awards that he had achieved was unbelievable. And unfortunately, is no longer with us. And you know, as you promote. The reason why the leadership behaviors are so important, because as you promote and you become in a position of senior leadership, you become isolated. So when you're one of the guys and girls that are on the grassroots, you're connected, you're well in, and you know, everybody knows and it can speak to you on the level. As you start to promote, you become dislocated from them, and you're now the old person, or you're now the one that they don't want to tell anything to because you're the boss. And all of a sudden then, when you become top of the tree, like you have been, you move from connection into dislocation, and dislocation into isolation. And when you and that is something, when I asked you about, well, who do you have 5 minutes to, if you were in anything but isolation, then you would say, oh, I've got so-and-so. And it's something that organizations, not just the police or the military or any other public service, but organizations in general really do need to understand, because you have high functioning, highly driven individuals that drive an organization that are working all the hours that they possibly can, because that's what they want to do, but absolutely burn out. And by doing that, what they start to do is isolate themselves. They didn't realize they're doing it. And then all of a sudden they got nothing. They get injured, home falls apart, work starts falling apart. And like you said, with the burners, all of them start then just to, it's a raging inferno that you can't control anymore. All of which can be manipulated at the start of that journey. But I wonder how much is individual and how much is organizational. And it's probably a blend of the two that end up making that equation that equals X, as it were.
I totally agree with what you're saying. It's true. And quite a few people commented going, it's lonely at the top. They say it quite funnily. And it's like, yeah, it is. And,
but no one does anything about it.
Well, they don't. Some organisations, I think, are getting quite a weight to this now. And don't get me wrong, I was quite a unique situation where, because I was last year, I was all over the place. I wasn't physically in a place to have a conversation with about me and my personal space. I didn't feel comfortable as a leader saying that to some of my juniors, so some of those sergeants, because they've got stuff going on. They don't need to hear what my problems, sort of thing like that. They've got enough going on, and I, you know, they need to concentrate on what they're doing, and I don't want to almost burden them with that. If I'd probably, as an individual, we talk about organisation, individual, I was wrong. Individually, I was wrong. The organization, you know, there are coping mechanisms in place, there are procedures in place, but as a whole, organizations, private, corporate, you know, whatever, we could do it a lot better, I think, in the sort of thing. But as an individual, I got it wrong. And like I said, I ostracized the very people I should have been having those conversations and having those 5 minutes with, because I just got it wrong. I wanted to make it succeed so badly. And I was so involved, and the motivation to drive that was so unique that health to one side, it was like, you know, I was pushing my health to one side to make it work. And, you know, my home life, everything. I look back now, I'm like, well, I was nuts. But, it still would have worked. It would have been fine. But I just managed it in the wrong way for me personally.
So what's next for you then?
Next for me, so obviously I've taken full advice for myself around that kind of lesson learned. And I think it's to keep going. I love my job. I have a great job. I move more into a strategic role within policing, but it's great and I love it. And I think it's having that work-life balance and continuing to be a mentor for people, helping people progress. I'm a big one around that. And I think really, making sure that my teams, people I know, where I can, where I speak about the work-life balance, sort of really adhere to it. And I hate when I give the talk about Westminster, it's almost like I'm saying, this is what happened to me, learn from it. This is what happened to me at the work-life balance thing where we went wrong last year and where I really regret it. Learn from it. And so if I can help people to not do that, then it's a great thing. So that for me, I think next is just to keep going within the organization, because it is a great place to work. Don't get wrong, the police is a fantastic place to work. Challenging, but it's fantastic.
Ed, it's been amazing talking to you. Like, I've really enjoyed the stories from, you know, from your younger days, but also I've appreciated your honesty in the more recent years to do with your career, and I found it fascinating. Thanks for your time, mate. And I'll catch up with you soon.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, Ryan. Have a good one, mate.
Cheers.